From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Roughly one in 40 children in the United States has been diagnosed with autism. That's according to a study published this week in the journal Pediatrics. Joining us to discuss the new data is developmental psychologist Bryna Siegel, who has worked to understand and treat autism for more than 40 years. As a UCSF professor and now as head of the Autism Center of Northern California. Her new book is called The Politics of Autism. And coming up, we'll talk with her about what she says are serious problems with autism research, and we'll get the latest facts about diagnosis and treatment. It's all coming up next, after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Estimates of the number of Americans diagnosed with autism have increased from about 1 in 1,000 to, that was back in the 1960s, to 1 in 40 today. That's according to a new report, in fact, in the journal Pediatrics. But those numbers don't tell the whole story. That's according to the Autism Center of Northern California director Bryna Siegel, who is critical of current research practices. In her new book, The Politics of Autism, she details the rise of misinformation about the developmental disorders and the lack of resources for parents. She joins us this hour to explain where autism diagnosis and treatment is going wrong and how to fix it. And I'd mention that we have done a number of programs on autism. As many of our listeners know, this is one person's perspective, but one person's who had about 40 years as a researcher and in the field. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bryna Siegel's book is called The Politics of Autism. She's now executive director, as I said, of the Autism Center of Northern California, and I should add, is a retired professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at UCSF. So why these numbers continue to go up? I know a lot of it is the spectrum has changed, and this particular new study asked parents and asked people who live with autistic adults and so forth, but the numbers just keep going sky high. You talk about diagnosing for dollars. That's a lot of it, too, isn't it?
There's diagnosing for dollars as part of it. I can address your question in two ways. One, we could take a quick look at this article that just came out in Pediatrics and was all over the place in the news yesterday. First of all, it relied on parents who responded to an internet survey, which is a selected group right there, and parents who often had their children diagnosed or screened early for autism. And we know that when kids are diagnosed with autism very early, while that is an important thing to do to give them the chance to receive early intervention, the diagnosis of autism looks a lot like other things early on, that when you're looking at a two-year-old who doesn't talk, for example, they could have autism, but they could have a severe language disorder or a temporary language disorder, or they could have intellectual disability or mental retardation, as we used to call it. They could have an anxiety disorder. They could come from a family where the TV's on 24/7 and no one ever talks to them. And so we find that a lot of the kids diagnosed early may not persistently have autism. And once you get that diagnosis, the diagnosing for dollars that you mentioned, you're getting many more services for your child with that autism diagnosis. Parents don't exactly run back to a clinician and say, please tell me, can you take this diagnosis away from me so my child can get less help?
One of the big arguments, though, that you present in the book, which I think is central to your what you seem to be putting forward here and advocating, is that because the book is a kind of guide to lifetime autism.
Yes.
And yet there's too much emphasis on early development to the exclusion of other developmental problems. I know that that's pretty much the course you take. But also, there's concern that you express about children being put into special education, and not only in terms of their losing something in the process, but their fellow students losing something in the process, or put into mainstream education, which can work the same way.
Yes, I think that was a real important focus for me to get to in this book. A lot of our practice of using inclusion and mainstreaming for children with autism, which means taking a child who has an IEP, is recognized to have special needs, and basically concluding that this best special education is to not give them a special ed teacher, but put them in a regular classroom, I think deprives a child often of special education. Parents have inflated expectations of what a one-to-one aide who's required to have 6 units of community college training can do compared to someone with a master's degree in special education. But importantly, when I go and see such children, every child with autism can be described in terms of several different developmental levels, which means they may be 5, but they're understanding language like a 3-year-old and speaking like a 2.5-year-old. And maybe they can do puzzles like a 5-year-old, but maybe their social skills at initiating with other children are like a 14-month-old. And so you put them in a class with a bunch of other 5-year-olds, and the other children find them babyish, and they might be kind of big sister, big brother a bit, but often these children are actually excluded from the very social world that their parents would like to think they're getting included and are part of. And as the teacher talks, she's talking to 5-year-olds like they're 5-year-olds. And then these children don't really understand what's happening. And so then someone says, well, maybe they have an attention deficit disorder, too, because they're fidgety during instruction.
Yeah, I remember one of the Sopranos episodes where Tony was told his kid was fidgety and therefore might be ADD or may have autism. They, you know, that great delivery that James Gandolfini. Fidgeting, you know, but this is a spectrum, and it's a very difficult spectrum sometimes to really just get into and laser on, and yet that label of autism has become so, in many ways, much wider than it ever was.
It's very broad, and if you picture, think about, you know, high school geometry and think of Venn diagrams of overlapping circles, the symptoms of autism overlap with many things. And that's part of the problem. One of this article that you brought up that was in the news yesterday, even the chief scientific officer of Autism Speaks, which has been the number one U.S. private agency promoting autism awareness, was skeptical of the numbers. Yet you can go down to Mission Street in San Francisco and many places in the U.S. and see a full-sized billboard that says shows a picture cartoon of a little kid covering their ears and lots of things making sound around that child, saying auditory sensitivity, a sign of autism. And so parents, people driving by, you see that and you think, oh, gee, I saw a child covering their ears. I thought it was the fire engine going by. I wonder if that child had autism. And so I think we have so much autism awareness these days that, and this is true of all psychiatric disorders, people are doing much more self-diagnosis of autism. In other words, if you have 10 neighbors that suggest to you, I see your child covering his ears, have you thought he might have autism? As a parent, you can't help
getting concerned.
Wonder that.
But there's really only one test, the ADOS test, right?
Well, it's interesting that you said that. The ADOS or ADOS, I think, is part of the problem, honestly. I've used the test since its inception and at one point even trained people in using it, and I kind of became disillusioned with it. One of the reasons is that it doesn't have any differential diagnosis criteria, meaning that you get a score, and if your score, depending on your age and so forth, let's say you're at an age where a score over 15 means you're autistic. There's no score that, well, what score would you get if you had a language disorder instead? What score would you get if you were severely mentally retarded instead? What score would you get if you were very anxious and afraid of the examiner instead? What if you are working with an examiner who's not very good at doing anything with 2-year-old children and you don't like this guy and just want to sit on your mom's lap and hide? You're going to get an autism score.
And is that an antiquated test then?
It's not antiquated, but
I mean, is it something that should be retired?
No, I think it. I use it. I think it has a lot of good uses as a condensed way to press a child to interact, to talk, and to do different things. But I think it has its limitations. And even the developers will say it has to be used in the context of good history taking and good clinical observation. But it's kind of become reified, and people talk about it as a gold standard. And it isn't, because children often get an ADOS from different people, and they get different scores depending on how good, experienced, friendly the examiner is and whether the child's having a good day or not, or whether it's being done in, as it often is, in a university hospital setting where the child is in a room that also smells like they might get a shot.
But it's also, I mean, I think almost a given from what you've been saying that there's not only is the spectrum so wide, but the manifestations of what are called autistic behavior are so wide.
Right. So in the criteria used by the American Psychiatric Association, we now have what's called DSM-5, a fifth iteration. Prior was DSM-4. In DSM-4, it just simply stated, like a legal contract, you couldn't have autism and ADHD. They took that out of DSM-5, and lo and behold, about a third of kids with autism suddenly have ADHD too, because the symptoms overlap so much.
We should mention that the DSM is essentially the handbook, the guiding handbook for different kinds of symptoms and different behavioral disorders or disorders of really all kinds. Let's go back to education, though. I mean, in many respects, what you argue in the book, The Politics of Autism, is it should be more geared toward the individual who has autism, I mean, and who has perhaps learning disabilities along with that autism, because many of these kids who are autistic, many of these children are autistic, they live in their own worlds, and you have to pretty much interact with those worlds if you're going to move forward. So why not, in fact, maybe work toward vocational education or things along those lines? This seems to be where you're going in your book.
Yeah, you've said two, I think, different and both very important things there. One is that an earlier book I wrote, which was called Helping Children with Autism Learn, talked about, let's forget about DSM, and let's really think of autism as a learning disability syndrome. Because it's so different, there is no autism, quote unquote, to treat. There are autism symptoms to treat. And if a child doesn't imitate, they have to learn to imitate. If they don't read facial expression, they need to learn to read facial expressions and so on. And so breaking it down into autistic learning disabilities gives certainly a teacher or a therapist a roadmap about how to remediate that child. But the part about vocational education, which kind of derives from that.
Because, or forgive me, life skills as well.
Life skills. Yeah. Life skills and vocational education both, to me, come in to the flip side of autistic learning disabilities, which is what I've called autistic learning styles. What does this child do well? That a lot of time we spend trying to get the child to do better what he doesn't do well instead of teaching him to use his strengths.
Gear it to the youngster.
Gear it to the child. What does this child do well? Well, if a child has very good visual spatial skills, and an example I gave a minute ago was a five-year-old who does put together puzzles like five-year-olds, well, let's give him visual schedules to follow. You know, first in class, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that. And that's a technique that's used. But then as we get into the older grades and we look at job training, we should be thinking about jobs that require assembly and putting things together in an order. And we look at what's going on in Europe, where kids are in England and in Germany are getting testing around age 14 and get tracked into polytechnic education or into more academic education. We don't have anything like that here. And in fact, vocational education has almost completely disappeared. And then on the flip side, we have this idea that the core curriculum is this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for everybody. And if you have a child who is not speaking at age 8, research tells us they're not likely to be verbal. And so why you're continuing to, let us say, beat a dead horse, rather than letting that child do something he does well. If he can visualize things and organize things, let's build on those skills.
It's interesting you're saying, hey, because actually disproportionately we're talking about boys, aren't we?
We're talking about boys 4 out of 5 times. But importantly, I think a lot of when we see the teenagers, or I see teenagers, they're being evaluated. Do they need antipsychotic medication? Do they need medication for inattention? Do they need medication for anxiety? Well, if you did a cruel experiment with me and locked me up with some Berkeley Nobel laureate physicists and try to teach me physics, I would be anxious and distracted after a couple of hours because it's not what I can learn. And so I think that we're seeing a lot of kids with autism who have symptoms that are their only way of responding to repeatedly being taught things that don't allow them to utilize their strengths and only beat them up over their weaknesses. And I think in the service of humanity, we need to be doing something a little different.
Talking with Bryna Siegel, she's executive director of the Autism Center in Northern California. Her new book is called The Politics of Autism. There's a poignant story in your book about and this is probably representative of what many parents have to go through, you know, a father thinking, do I put money away for a trust fund when my child is an adult and still is going to be autistic, or do I take this money and try to find some kind of way to move the child forward now? I mean, there's really this sense of trying to plan for the future that's implicit in what parents have to look toward, because there's a lot of misinformation out there on the internet. And it's not only about vaccines, it's about cures, it's about treatment, the whole gamut. In fact, let me go there for a moment with you, because there's some new information that I find fascinating and I'd like you to address, and that is, apparently, we've talked a lot about Russian involvement in our elections and everything, but there are bots and Russians who are spreading information about, well, which is appealing, I suppose, to those who are against vaccines. And I know you are one of those who says categorically that, you know, vaccines have nothing to do with autism. There are people who dispute that.
I'm a scientist.
Right. You don't have to apologize for that. But, you know, they're saying that Russians are using bots to kind of upset or do something to our public health system so that, you know, kids are going to be getting, you know, this herd effect and chicken pox all over the place.
Well, that's really interesting. An article just came out in the American Journal of Public Health. And it looks at Russian bots, and it is, and trolls, and I can't say that I can give you a good definition of the difference between a bot and a troll, but my understanding is what the computer scientists who wrote this article did is that they were able to trace IP addresses for certain hashtags, like don't vaccinate kind of hashtags, and were able to trace them to this Russian Internet security agency that's been implicated in a lot of the election meddling, and that the idea is that they want people to, and a lot of the content has to do with, you know, the government is not your friend, Big Pharma is willing to kill your kids to make a profit, and that all these antisocial messages are being
Well, there may be some truth to some, I mean, Big Pharma and interested in profiteering or whatever.
Well, I think it's true, but I don't think they're trying to kill kids with vaccines, because I mean, a lot of the argument about vaccines came from that there were mercury poisoning and mercury. The mercury was taken out of the vaccines more than 15 years ago.
We've done whole programs on this, and they're in our archives.
Yes.
But the thing about the Russians somehow involved in this is really sort of fascinating, and a whole line of discourse that I hadn't no familiar with. And speaking about things I don't have any familiar with, what's on the horizon in terms of treatment or ways of dealing with autism?
I think we need a lot more research. And when we look at how the federal government and private donors have been spending money on autism research, what we see is about 75% of dollars is going to looking for genes, looking at the neuroscience of autism. And all of this is really important stuff. However, we now have 30 years of autism genetics work, and of that 30 years, we've identified about 150 genes. They are only in about 15% of people with autism, and some of those genes are inherited. So you have the geek dads, as you mentioned. But, you know, is that useful for genetic counseling to tell a geek dad that this gene is present in his fetus? I would argue not. But a lot of the genes are de novo mutations, meaning that they're not inherited at all. I think this work is important. It's helped us understand which genes are instrumental in developing which parts of the brain and neuronal development and in understanding the neurochemistry of the brain. But none of this work has helped improve the life of a single child or adult with autism. And the same is true of the neuroimaging work. And I think this work should be done. But I argue in the politics of autism that we shouldn't be calling it autism research. We should be taking money for autism research and using it to help people, children and families living with autism instead, and acknowledging that the work that I've just described is basic science.
Let me do this. I know there are many listeners who are not only interested in the basic science of autism, such as it is, but also what to do about the concern that many have, not only those of you who have are parents of autistic children, but those who live with autism or have experienced it. It's a pretty big spectrum now, and I know there are many questions, and so let me open the phone lines and invite you to join us with Bryna Siegel, who's Executive Director of the Autism Center in Northern California, author of The Politics of Autism. Our phone lines are open, and the number to call for your calls is 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement. Please feel free to join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also be part of this program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's a comment from a listener who tweeted us, "Diagnosing for dollars is absurd. We know from research that if anything, autism is underdiagnosed, especially in girls, people of color, kids from low socially economic status scenarios. Yes, there is always a small percentage of diagnostic error, but that is a dangerous misdirection."
I don't agree with that. First of all, I think that's very easy to say and has sort of a politically correct ring to it. I do think it can be harder for less educated and more disadvantaged families to get autism diagnoses. But one of our missions now at the Autism Center for Northern California, which I wasn't able to do at UCSF, is we have contracts with Medi-Cal in California for San Francisco, Alameda, Contra Costa counties, and all the counties north of Marin and North and several of the other coastal counties. And we're seeing tons of Medi-Cal kids. And most of what we're seeing is Medi-Cal kids. So these parents do have access, and they have an ability to get diagnostic assessments for their children. And Medi-Cal is funding treatment programs for their children, and special education, which is available to all, is funding treatments for their children. And when children walk into a school and they're assessed, they're as likely to get an IEP if they're from a poor family or they're from a Black family or a Latino family or a non-.
What is an IEP?
An individual educational plan. Basically, it's a contract which says that the school recognizes that your child is not learning like other children in a significantly different way, entitles the parents to a really detailed psychological assessment, much as done in a university medical center, as to what is wrong and what services are needed. And those services can cost $60,000 a year. But the school, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a federal law, are mandated to provide that. And so these children do have access to services both diagnostically through their public insurance and in terms of treatment through the educational system. So it's not so cut and dry.
You've also expressed some concern about what you call an American can-do attitude, that anything can be fixed. So people go into autism sometimes with they need to be disabused of the idea that there's a way to fix this, there's a magic pill, there's simply even some kind of panacea.
Well, in the early 1990s, a fellow named Ivar Lovaas, who's a professor of psychology at UCLA, came out with a paper in a journal called Mental Retardation, in which he claimed to have cured half of children with autism with intensive early behavioral therapy. And it made an enormous impact. And these days, we still have a lot of children receiving intensive ABA, very costly for a very long time. We no longer are claiming it cures half. But what we are doing is something you alluded to, which is that we have this front loading of dollars spent on autism treatment in the early years and nothing left for most of the child's life.
We'll talk some more with Bryna Siegel and we'll go to your calls. If you're on the line, hang on. We'll get to them as soon as we return from a brief break. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Bryna Siegel here with us in studio. She's Executive Director of the Autism Center of Northern California, and she's the author of a new book called The Politics of Autism. And I'm going to go right to your calls. Let me go first to Carol. Carol, you join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. I'm a first-time long-term listener, a first-time caller.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm concerned because I have a great-granddaughter who has been just diagnosed. She's just turning two, been diagnosed with the very lowest level on the autism scale. She is speech delayed. However, her mother speaks sign language fluently, and she does a lot of signs. She does signs appropriately. She puts signs together. She just doesn't really want to say words. She does a lot of jibber-jabbering, but she doesn't want to say words. But she's been diagnosed on this autism scale to get these different services, and I'm concerned about her being being diagnosed at this point when I think it's a speech delay. By the way, I'm a retired special ed teacher, and I have dealt with autistic children. And she does not live in this kind of autistic world. She's very social. She reacts to people appropriately. So I'm concerned about this early diagnosis.
Some thoughts from you, Dr. Siegel?
Carol, you could be right. I think that it would be important for your granddaughter to get some further assessment.
It's her really, great-granddaughter.
The mom is her granddaughter.
Oh, you're talking about, okay.
Her mom, the granddaughter, needs to get another opinion. You've said something important, which is right now, at this age, she's going to get more services with a diagnosis of autism, but it's also going to be important for your daughter to get someone to follow her. One of the things that we're doing at the Autism Center of Northern California, which I wasn't able to do at UCSF, is really invest in the continuity of care. I think a lot of the major clinics do what I call diagnose and adios. They work the kid up, they give them a diagnosis, and out the door they go, and there is no plan for follow-up. And I think when we start to follow up children like this, and we see that at age 3, their delayed language has caught up, and that their intact social skills really have come to the fore, then the diagnosis of autism isn't there, but importantly, the treatment tools that you can use, the way you can motivate this child is going to be very different if she doesn't have an autism diagnosis. And so you need to keep track of what's happening with this child's improvements in order to constantly update her treatment planning.
And Carol, good luck with this. Thank you so much for joining us. This is another indication, it seems to me, of maybe quick on the draw with the diagnoses. Here's Peter who writes, and it's an important question. There's a common perception, he says, that autism spectrum disorders are concentrated among children of the better off and better educated. Is there an actual correlation with socioeconomic status, or is it just that we hear mostly from the kinds of parents who have resources to get diagnoses and get public attention?
I think we hear a lot from parents who can get public attention. And it's sort of one of, I guess, my hobby horses to ride, is that a lot of the stories that get into the media are parents who've really had incredible creativity and resources to bring to bear. And it's wonderful for their children, but it's not necessarily representative of the general population. And the reason I'm kind of even focus on this is that children with autism, some parents will use this expression, if you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child with autism. And I think that when parents see these stories, they may be seeing a story about a child who is much less handicapped than their child, and then they feel very depressed that their child is more handicapped, or they may be seeing a story about a child who's more handicapped than their child and feel scared that their child may be developing additional symptoms. And so it's a very complex disorder for parents to come to terms with. Thanks for that comment.
And let me just ask you, because it's something that's been of concern, I know, to many parents of autistic children, too much psychiatric medications prescribed?
I think so. I think that, we're treating symptoms with psychiatric medications. We're never treating the diagnosis of autism. And as I said, I think sometimes when I go and look into what's going on in the child's life, and the behaviorists will call it a functional behavior analysis, but often they don't take into account that what you're trying to teach this child at school or what you're expecting him to do, if it's beyond his developmental level, you're going to get bad behavior. You're going to get anxiety, aggression, eloping from school, all kinds of things that kids end up getting medicines for, and instead changing their educational plan into something that gives them skills they can master might alleviate the need for so much medication.
Let me go to another caller, and that's you. Madhu, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the founder of an organization called Inclusive World. We work with, we call them differently abled teens and young adults, and we teach them vocational skills and do job placements. So, Dr. Siegel, what you talked about, the lack of vocational skills and really working on the strengths rather than fixing the weakness, that really hit home. So my question to you is, why are there not more programs on vocational skills and job placements, which in America it seems to be really lacking, but other countries seem to be doing a much better job of that?
It's a big question, and it's certainly been alluded to and written about by our guest, Brenda Siegel.
Yeah, thank you for that comment, Madhu, because that's exactly right. I think there's too much emphasis in the American education system on college preparation, and it's not necessarily the right fit for everyone. And for kids who have disabilities or learn differently or however you want to characterize it, often starting with a simple job as an apprenticeship with mentorship and a lot of repetition that allows the job to be seen as it's done and does it repetitively, and allowing the individual to get a sense of success and mastery, you can always give more complicated tasks over time. You can add to the tasks. You can add additional steps to the task. But the idea that you have to get a degree before you can work, I think, is wrong, and that it sounds like what you're doing is really incredibly important. Thank you.
Let me thank Madhu for the call. And we've been getting a number of comments like this, and it's puzzling to me in some ways. Kelly says, I'm a regular listener, and as someone who is not autistic, I don't need to hear from other folks who aren't. I need to hear the experiences of people who are autistic. Should say that we have certainly done programs along those lines, but the implication of that is that someone who's a professional maybe can't speak about what they professionally are investigating or dealing with. I'm not sure I understand.
I disagree with that. I think, first of all, the people with autism who advocate for autism, who themselves have autism, are a very select subset, and they often don't represent the fact that many people with autism remain nonverbal throughout their life. So they're not really talking for themselves. Many of them are not able to express themselves well enough to have a public voice. And so this is a very selected sample of individuals. And I don't think that they've experienced some of the difficulties that more disabled individuals have experienced. And therefore, I don't think they're in a particularly great position to speak knowledgeably on behalf of those people. And
well, there are autistic people who are fully functional in so many different ways and fluent and using language and et cetera, but they're on the spectrum.
There are, but the way they're on the spectrum is very, very attenuated compared to most people who are living with autism. And one of the things we haven't talked about here yet is that autism, as it was defined like in the 80s, that about 70% also had some intellectual disability with it and 30% didn't. And now this huge explosion in people with autism has shown that 70% don't have intellectual disability and 30% do, which means that the new counts, the new cases are coming from these more minimally affected individuals. And that's worth noting, but it's a different kind of autism.
It's more Asperger in many ways, isn't it?
Asperger is one term which now has kind of gone out of popular usage very quickly. But those individuals have the core social learning disability, the inability to engage in the perspective of others and change their actions based on how others are thinking and feeling. They're not motivated to do that. And that core problem is really what's there in some high-functioning people with autism. But that's just part of the story, and that many with autism are dealing with a much wider range of problems, and the young kids are dealing with much wider range of problems. And I'm not sure that people who are high-functioning adults with autism can speak to that, as well as the parents of those children who are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. And that's who I'm talking
about. But when you're writing a book about the politics of autism, it doesn't mean you have to be autistic to understand what the politics are.
No, thank you.
Go to another caller. Suzanne, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Talking about the politics of autism, it is mandated by law that these, you know, children have access to attention to be diagnosed and everything else. But the way it plays out in the inner city schools is that the classes are large. Kids don't get diagnosed they don't have the resources. They'll call for a speech therapist and whatever, and I'm talking about Oakland Unified right now, and they don't come through. They don't answer the phone. I mean, it's a horrible, unequal way that it plays out. So having access and having the attention needed and equally is something that does not happen. And that needs to be addressed in a real way, because all of these children fall through these cracks, and they already are coming from families with situations that, you know, have them less than already.
Suzanne, I thank you for that call. Let me hear what Bryna Segal has to say in response to your comment.
I think that I'm very familiar with Oakland Unified School District's work with kids with autism, and I think one of the things that is very effective, one of the things we do at the Autism Center of Northern California, is we have a program that's called Jumpstart Learning to Learn. And when parents first get the diagnosis, and this is a program that's paid for by Regional Center, which is the developmental agency in the state of California responsible for kids 0 to 3, parents come in for a week of intensive parent training to learn what autism is. And to me, it's just like if your kid had been diagnosed with being deaf, you'd have to learn sign language to reach your child. If your child had been diagnosed with diabetes, you'd have to quickly learn how to manage that disorder. And when we spend a week with parents teaching them how to get their children to look at them, how to get them to follow directions, how to get them to talk, how to get them to play with toys in a way that's like other children and becomes a motivating way to learn language. We teach this to the parents, and in doing so, we give the parents vocabulary that the professionals use in teaching those things, so that parents can go into a meeting with the regional center or a meeting with the school and not be railroaded. They can be the expert on their child, not just sit there and let a lot of people go around the table and tell them what their child needs or doesn't need. And I think that developing parent expertise so that each parent has a legitimate foundation for advocating for their child, not just going in and being angry that their child can't do this or can't do that or isn't getting something that they know another child is getting, is one, it's not a cure, but it's a step in the right direction.
Let me thank the caller and go to some listener responses. Some of them are pushing back. Emily says, diagnosing for dollars is preposterous and insulting. Stop trivializing the tidal wave of autism. And here's a listener who tweets, autistic people don't live in their own world. They live in the same world as everyone else with a different and generally misunderstood experience. Non-autistic people need to work harder to understand and support autistic people's experiences and abilities. And Cynthia says, or asks, my nephew is 30 years old and might have autism. Where does an adult get help since he is no longer in school? His school records say that he had mental retardation. He has difficulty holding down a job. And here's the hardest part. He doesn't want to be diagnosed as being different. What would you recommend?
At the Autism Center of Northern California, we actually have an adult diagnostic clinic. But the focus of the clinic is not so much diagnosis per se, but what are you going to do now? Trying to make a plan based on what I was early referring to as autistic learning disabilities and autistic learning styles. Often adults have symptoms of other psychiatric disorders that need to be addressed. A really comprehensive look at what's been tried so far and what's gone wrong, setting realistic goals. It's a real take a village thing that if the 30-year-old is living with his parents, you know, how can we get the family to be part of this? Unfortunately, we find that a lot of parents who have young adults with autism living with them kind of infantilize them. They do their laundry and cook their meals and don't allow them to have the opportunity or force them to have to do things to make a better adaptation for themselves.
I'm sorry, too many parents do that with non-autistic children, too.
Well, yes.
There's a very positive remark, though, from a listener named Carolina, who writes, one of my sons got diagnosed with Asperger's at the age of 3.5. We got 10 hours of applied behavior analysis services through our health insurance. We work with a fantastic therapist for over 3 years. My son is now 8.5, and he is doing great socially, emotionally, and academically, and I'm convinced that the ABA services played a critical role in training us, the parents, in how to raise a child on a spectrum.
Congratulations. I think you're probably right. And I think that ABA services can be extremely effective and powerful done well. So that's a wonderful story to hear.
Let's hear from some more of our listeners. We go next to Oakland and welcome Jacob. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a 28-year-old from the Midwest who's been in the Bay for a number of years. And I have had a friend since middle school, a good friend, with a high-functioning form of autism. And it's just been a struggle for myself and his mom to, you know, learn a lot of the topics that have been discussed today and, you know, maybe not hearing it, but how to support my friend and her son. And I just wondered if you have any advice. My friend is high functioning, and we share interests. But as our lives divulge and we grow in different areas, we struggle to find areas to push and try and help him grow, and at the same time, you know, just entertain what's easy and what's good and things we have in common already. And just if you have any thoughts on...
Certainly challenging questions you're raising, and let me go to Bryna Siegel on this. I mean, to help, any wisdom or
It's a really poignant story, and it's not the first time I've encountered that. Sometimes some of the adults who come into our adult clinic come in with friends, people who have been their friends since early childhood, and they've continued to be friends. But just as you say, your lives begin to diverge. And I think really it's about looking at your friend with high-functioning autism and thinking about what can he do well? How can he get satisfaction in his life? You may be looking to get a degree or to get married or to have kids, but what kind of work can he be doing that would give him satisfaction and make him feel happy and independent and define how he wants to interact with other people? And it may not be the same things that you're aiming for, but if you can support him in doing that and it can be identified, then that's great.
Let me thank Jacob for the call, and let me go to another caller here. This is Lauren from Oakland. Lauren, you're an educational therapist?
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. So I've worked with kids who have autism, and I see that they have balance and crossing the midline issues, and I'm wondering why they don't receive enough occupational therapy as part of their services. It seems that the insurance is focused more on ABA as opposed to occupational therapy.
Well, there's a couple answers to that. One is a couple years ago, California had something which I'm sure you know called SB 946, which the California legislature mandated medically necessary autism treatment be paid for by medical insurers. And I actually was on the commission that was then charged with developing those standards. And actually, much to the disappointment, my disappointment, and contrary to what most of us on the committee worked for, most of the money has gone for ABA. And ABA is very important and very powerful, but it shouldn't be where all the money is going. We did look at occupational therapy treatments for autism, and we found that, in particular, sensory integration therapy was not evidence-based. And so we said that's not going to be paid for. The insurance companies don't have to pay for it. But it doesn't mean that occupational therapists are not useful, and they are useful in helping children with specific deficits like crossing midline or learning to hold a pencil or doing other adaptive tasks. And the insurance should pay for the child to have therapy for that.
Let me go to a comment from a listener. Actually, be interested in hearing what you have to say, Bryna Siegel, to Glenn's comment here. He says, I think we should bring back separated diagnosis for Asperger's and other less debilitating forms of autism spectrum disorder so that autism diagnoses and services are reserved for those who truly have that condition. It seems that children and adults with truly profound autism are disadvantaged by widespread misinformation that often downplays the debilitating nature of it. In other words, maybe we need to separate these because it's too diluting?
I actually absolutely agree with that. I mean, I was disappointed that Asperger's was taken out. I mean, what happened was that I was part of the field trials in DSM-4 that created Asperger's as a separate diagnosis. And actually, when we tested a definition for it, that definition is not what ended up appearing in DSM-IV. It's a little known and really not really lovely story. But what happened was that after Asperger's became a official DSM diagnosis, I think there was a lot of clinicians who let their fingers do the walking in the DSM, and a lot of people started getting an Asperger's diagnosis who were very different from the standardization sample of people with Asperger's, what those of us who had read the research that went into creating that diagnosis thought of as Asperger's. And I would go to professional meetings, and all of my colleagues who were part of that study, we were all kind of running about 1 in 10 of people that would come to us with an Asperger's diagnosis that we thought matched the standardizing sample of what was supposed to be Asperger's syndrome. And so I think the people who really are these, as originally described by Lorna Wing, who was a head of the British Autism Society and really brought the term Asperger's into the English language literature, the active but odd, socially lacking theory of mind or planfulness in being able to understand what people mean by what they say, that group did get diluted. And I would like to see that be separate, because I think the adaptive capacities of those people and the language capacities of those people who really have what we started off wanting to call Asperger's syndrome are very different. And whether it's genetically a partial phenotype or a mild phenotype, you know, we can't even answer that question anymore because of how research data are now being collected that just slosh everybody into the same pot.
Our guest is Bryna Segal, and she's executive director of the Autism Center of Northern California and author of The Politics of Autism. Let me get another caller aboard, and that's Angie. Angie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a registered nurse with the Regional Center in Early Intervention, and I also have a son who's 15 who was diagnosed with autism at 4. We got services kind of late, but ABA was good. The school district has been a struggle to deal with, and now he's 15, and I'm thinking, what next? He's somewhat nonverbal, considerate, moderate, you know, the classic aloof autistic person, and I'm like, what next? I see a lot of front loading for the little ones, and I don't see a lot of things to look forward to later on. So I'm just, you know, thinking like, what's next for him and us as a family?
So Angie, you're really right. And I think that your story is one that really motivated me to write this book, The Politics of Autism. I don't know where you're located, but if you want to come into the Autism Center of Northern California, we could probably sit down and have a whole afternoon or morning of talking about this. But middle school is really kind of, or the entry to high school is really a, you know, fish or cut bait period of time where we need to look at where he went from 5 to 15 and think about where he's going to go from 15 to 25. You know, draw a line and look at the trajectory and try to figure out what can we be teaching him that he's going to be able to be good at and be able to master and allow him independence, and look at his learning style, what kind of things make him happy, and how do we use that to help him have a good quality of life? And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the family, it's a whole family thing. Does your whole family come to understand him and support him so that his development advances?
Let me thank the caller, Angie, and go to a tweet here from Steve Silberman. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's the author of Neurotribes and has been a guest on this program, and that interview is in our archives, and I have a great deal of respect for him. And he says, it's excruciating to hear Bryna Segal dismiss autistic self-advocates as not being representative of their community. She's playing into the most shallow high-functioning versus low-functioning stereotypes used to divide the autistic community.
Well, Steve, hi. I know that you saw your first high-functioning person with autism when you came to visit my clinic at UCSF. So you've obviously gone in directions of your own. I've read Neurotribes. I don't agree with you. I think the advocates are a nice community of acolytes for you to have, but I don't think it tells the whole story. And I think because you haven't spent time with the parents of the young kids and parents of the low-functioning kids and parents like Angie, who just called in, I don't think you have the whole story. I think that the advocates, self-advocates, do have something very important to say, but it's not the whole story.
Let me try to get another caller aboard with us, and that's Mina from Pleasanton. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Brenna. Michael, Brenna, I think Mina Doshi, we used to work together when I was at Regional Center many years ago. I don't know if you remember me, but I had a question about working with parents who have cultural stigmas around autism as far as assessment and getting their child evaluated. How do you have any ideas of how to address that effectively?
Yeah, can you reflect some wisdom on that, Brenna Siegel?
I'll try. Right now, I had mentioned that the Autism Center of Northern California, we do a lot of business with Medi-Cal, seeing children who are economically from less able families. And that means that about 40% of our kids are Cantonese or usually sometimes Mandarin speaking, and about another 40% are Spanish speaking. So we're seeing most of our kids are coming with interpreters, and we have a few interpreters we've really come to like who can understand what the families are going through. But I think it's very difficult. I think that the Asian families come from a culture where there is a belief in Dharma, in that if you have a child with a disability, there is bad stuff coming home to roost, that everybody's going to see you have this disabled child, and it's showing that there's some bad stuff in your family, and it's very shameful. And while that's not an explicit belief, I think that it creates a difficulty and anxiety for those parents to access the social support that they should otherwise be able to get from their community and from their extended family.
It's a good note to conclude here, because we need to get rid of that stigma as best we can and the shame that's associated with it. And Brenna Siegel, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you with us on Forum this morning. Brenna Siegel is again the author of a new book called The Politics of Autism. She's executive director of Autism Center of Northern California. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Hope you'll stay tuned. And by the way, feel free to continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And for all of us here at the Forum program and at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.